Greetings, loyal listeners. We have a very special recording for you today that addresses women's history. Our guest today is Dr. Mazie Huff, University of Maine Professor Emerita of History and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies. Mazie is an American social historian with a focus on women's history of the early 20th century. Her dissertation was a comparative study of the community response to unwed mothers in Maine and Tennessee from 1874 to 1954. Her work has included research on women and reform, legal history, social activism, and Maine women's history. She is a member of the Somali Narratives Project, a collaborative interdisciplinary project which is gathering interviews in Lewiston, Maine in order to document the experiences of Somali immigrants. She is also a member of the Maine Feminist Oral History Project, which is working collectively on a history of Spruce Run Association, now Partners for Peace, of Bangor, Maine, one of the oldest domestic violence projects in the country. Dr. Huff, Mazie, thank you for being our honored guest today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
My pleasure. Me too. Let's start off with, if I could ask you a question that has two parts, sort of past and present. Can you share with our audience what you see as some of the biggest social justice issues women have faced historically? And what do you see as the most pressing social justice issues facing women today?
Well, I really appreciate the way that you framed this. Instead of just saying, tell us about women, you're saying, tell us about the social issues, social justice issues, which, as you can imagine, are legion within the study of women and gender in the United States and probably worldwide. Since you shared the framework with me earlier, I have had a lot of time to think about it. At first, I began to list all the injustices that women had faced over time, and there were many of them. But then I realized that there was one that really stood out head and shoulders over the others, and that is the control of women's reproductive lives. By that, I mean not just birth control and abortion, as critical as they are, but also the laws and practices that over a time have attempted to control women when they give birth, whom they have children with, whether they have children or not, and what happens to their children once they've had them. So if we look historically, and I'll just list a few of the things that have happened over time, Dr. Marion Sims, who would become deemed the father of gynecology, made his name when he experimented on slave women without anesthesia, numerous slave women. After the Civil War, white Southern men used rape as a tool to discourage free men from voting. Towards the end of the century, states across the country initiated miscegenation laws, forbidding people to marry across racial lines, both black and white, but Native American, Asian American. At the same time, Indian women were having their children removed to residential schools where the children were forbidden to speak their own language. And the idea was to turn them into Americans, to, as one superintendent said, kill the Indian and save the man. In the 1920s and 1930s, eugenics laws made it legal to sterilize individuals who were deemed unfit, who would diminish the American stock. Not only black and brown people, but poor unmarried mothers as well. Oliver Wendell Holmes, when he determined that this was all legal, said, three generations of imbeciles is enough. And he hardly paid attention to the women who were involved. And then in the 1970s, 25,000 Native American women were forcibly sterilized by the US government. And that was between 25 and 50% of the female population. So when you focus on these social injustices, you have to ask why. And I'm sure part of the answer is that human beings create damage, do damage. But in thinking about it, it led me to think about it in another way. And I really hold two things responsible, and I think it helps to explain the history of women in the United States. The one is the gender binary, and the other is the British common law. So the gender binary, as you know, because people are challenging it now and saying we are on a spectrum, specifically said there are men and women, they are very different, they should be treated differently, and they should have different rights. It is a very similar thing, and I think it helped to normalize the idea of a racial binary. So there are black and white people, and they have their own particular ways of acting and should have different disparate laws applied to them. What women were considered by nature over time, so the whole realm of the American history changed. At the beginning, women were supposedly very passionate and sexy and hard to control and wily, so they would lie. And of course, this fed into the whole idea of witchcraft, because that would be a perfect creator of a witch. Later, in the early 19th century, women then were supposed to be very pious and pure and suited for staying at home and taking care of children. And a little later on, in the 50s, women were supposed to be really adapted well to working in the home and using washing machines, taking care of their children. The understanding was they didn't want to do anything more. That was the whole thing that they desired. So that's the gender binary that I wanted to talk about. But the other thing is the British common law, which has an assumption that resonated over centuries in the United States. So when the first Europeans arrived in the United States, they all brought with them something called the common law from England. And what that said was that when women were married, they were femme couverte. They were covered by their husbands. They did not have the right to write wills, to sign contracts, to earn their own wages. Whatever they earned belonged to their husbands. They were not able to keep their children if, in fact, they did get a divorce. I'm sure many people who are listening to this have heard of the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention. And that was when Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott announced in the newspaper they were going to talk about women's issues. And 300 people arrived in a very short period of time. And over the course of a couple of days, they wrote what was called the Declaration of Sentiments. And what it said was, it started with, we hold these things to be we hold these things to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. And then they went into a discussion of what women had to face under the British common law. So here are just a few. The men in their world have compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she had no voice. He has made her morally an irresponsible being, as she can commit many crimes with impunity, provided she's with him. In other words, if she committed a crime and her husband was there, he was responsible and she wasn't. He has monopolized nearly all the profitable employments, and from those she can follow, she receives a very scanty remuneration. He has endeavored, they conclude, in every way that he could destroy her confidence in her own powers, to lessen her self-respect, and to make her willing to lead a dependent and abject life. So that's the statement of what they had to face, and they made a lot of proposals of what should happen. We all know that in 1920, finally, women got the vote. Though not Native American women, in Maine, they had to wait until 1954. And beginning in 1848, states passed property laws for women. In 1857, married women in Maine gained the right to control their wages so they could go out and work and keep the money that they made. In 1862, they gained the right to enter into contracts without their husband and decide what happened to their property when they died. And in 1884, married women had the right to own their property. So it was a gradual process. The property part of this whole legacy are really small compared to the whole thing. For example, it was not until 1974 that women could get loans without the signatures of their husbands or their fathers. And women did not have the right to serve on juries in all the states until 1973. Women still, and you probably all know this, only earn 83 cents to a man's dollar. And this is in spite of the fact that President Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act in 1963. So it's a very, very slow process. American women's history would be dismal if that were the sum total of it. But the really wonderful thing about studying American history is finding all these women who challenged the system and actually created change. Maine was apparently the first state to elect a woman to any office, which they did in 1853 when they elected Olive Rose as county register. In spite of opposition, Clara Hapgood Nash in Maine became the first woman in New England to be admitted to the bar. But into the early 1900s, the Maine Supreme Court insisted that women could not hold most elective office because Maine's constitution was written by men and did not specify that women had that right. So here's just a brief quote. By the constitution, the whole political power of the state is vested in its male citizens. Whenever in any of its provisions reference is made to sex, it is to duties to be done and performed by male members of the community. Nothing in the language of the constitution or in the debates of the convention indicates any purpose whatever of surrendering political power by those who had previously enjoyed it. So in other words, women were totally out of the picture. But women kept pushing. They kept pushing in Maine and nationally. One of my favorite women is Belva Lockwood, who was the first woman to argue before the Supreme Court. She was widowed at 22 with a three-year-old child. She taught school, then she moved to DC where she remarried. In 1876, she graduated from the DC National University Law School, and the men complained. They said, we don't want her to graduate with us. That's gonna demean our ability, you know, demean who we are for this. So she went to President Grant, and Grant said, okay, you get your degree. So she got her degree. Then she turned to the Supreme Court, and she said, I want to be able to come and argue in front of them. And the Supreme Court said, none but men are permitted to practice before us as attorneys or counselors. So she didn't give up. She went to the Congress. She lobbied indefatigably and finally got an act that was supposedly to relieve certain legal disabilities of women. So she went on to go before the Supreme Court. She won a very famous case, East Cherokee versus the United States. She won $5 million for the Cherokee. But she also, as she went on, rode a bicycle in Washington, D.C., which was not considered proper for a woman. She ran for president twice on the Equal Rights Party platform, and she tried to arrange a debate with Grover Cleveland and James Blaine. She said, I can't vote, because this is before women voted, but she said, people can vote for me, and about 5,000 people voted for her. So that's one of my favorite women. Another is Pauli Murray, a black woman who was enrolled in Howard Law School, where she was the only woman in her class, and was asked if she really wanted to take the place of a man. Didn't she want to let somebody else go in for her? She said no. She graduated at the top of her class, but was denied postgraduate work at Harvard because she was a woman. She said, I would gladly change my sex to meet your requirements, but since the way to such change has not been revealed to me, I have no recourse but to appeal to you to change your minds. Are you to tell me one is as difficult as the other? She would go on to work successfully to get Title IX passed, and you all know that enabled women to be athletes and get the same support that men did. So Maine had two women in 1927 and one in 1929 who were elected to the Maine legislature. The first one, Dora Pinkham, was always asked when the men came in if she minded if they smoked cigarettes or cigars, and she always had to say no, which she did. And then Gail Laughlin. Gail Laughlin initiated a law that was passed that prohibited men from committing their wives to insane asylums just because they wanted to do it. And you can imagine that was a particularly important thing. And one more, I want to give a shout out to Margaret J. Smith, who, as we all know, did the Declaration of Conscience. She was the first woman to be in the House and the Senate. But she had a role in enabling women to serve in the military, which I don't think is recognized so much. In 1948, just after World War II, with the end of the draft, Eisenhower really wanted women to be able to serve in the military, not in combat, but just to help support with the clerical work, et cetera. And a lot of men thought that was not a good idea. Some of the argument was they're menopausal, and once they hit menopause, then the military is going to have to support them, and they're going to act crazy. So you ought to just not let them join the military. But Margaret J. Smith, who was on the Armed Services Committee, insisted that the bill to make this possible go out of committee. She was the only one on the committee. If she had not done that, it wouldn't have gone out to debate and it wouldn't have been passed. But the Armed Services Integration Act passed as a result of that. I don't know, I could go on and on, but I think you asked about what is today the most critical issue. And I have to say, of course, that it's still reproductive justice. And I would talk about that from a whole wide ranging perspective, again, that of course we know what draconian laws are being enacted across the country now as far as women's access to abortion, and it may be that they also have to face limits on birth control, but it goes way beyond that. And when I talk about the binary, I think it's very important to realize how our women's world is expanding to include all kinds of people on the gender spectrum. And the whole assault on trans people is really upsetting and needs to be stopped. So we have that also as a reproductive issue. There are murdered and disappearing indigenous women is a huge problem right now across the country and in Canada. In a year, there may be as many as 6,000 women who are disappear with nobody knowing where they are. And the both countries are trying to step up their abilities to find out where these women are and to help this terrible crisis. And then I would say, building on the whole idea of reproductive justice is what also happens to your children. We have to think about climate change. We have to think about black women whose children, especially their male children, are threatened with police brutality and or death or prison, and they need support in any way they can.
Maisie, that's fascinating. Thank you so much. Listening to every word and picturing every experience that you were talking about, and absolutely, men and women are created equal.
Right.
Men and women are created equal. I listened to it with from a lot of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Probably my most personal one is as a father of three daughters, and the fact that whenever they as they were growing up, would assert themselves. I heard them several times into different family conversations, etc., about equality of women and equity of women. That was really, it's been terrific. And to see, their gifts are there for, because they have that as their philosophy, their gifts shine out. So all the examples that you shared, I've also felt a sadness of how many millions, tens, hundreds of millions of people's gifts were, kept out of the light because they weren't allowed to do certain things. And thank goodness that it doesn't feel like the domination, I'll just use that word, I was going to say that the dominant sort of roles aren't like what you said, the Maine Constitution was written by men, so it only applies to men. I mean, are you kidding me? So thank goodness that's not the case today. And then to think that some men would feel that if they had to share the graduation stage with a woman, that somehow demean them. Right. I mean, it strengthens them. Right. But before I get to the next question, you also made me think of a follow-up, if I could. And that is that, again, as I listen to this, and then as you were We're really highlighting the medical justice issue of the day in reproductive justice and the like. And what I'm wondering is the other way I was listening to you was putting myself in the shoes of a student, because you're a professor. And so you've taught your whole life as well. So you've connected with people. How would you describe, you know, what you have been hearing over the years, and how students either embrace this or talk about it, or do they struggle with it? Do they say, absolutely, you're right on? Or how would you describe the learning experience? Yeah.
That's a great question. And I would answer it by saying that there are some things that the students could not believe in. And one of them was that their reproductive rights were threatened. So they felt, when I started teaching in 2000, they thought that it was all one and we're fine, and you all back then made a big deal out of nothing, right? Which they won't think anymore. The other part is, though, especially teaching in a women's gender and sexuality studies classroom where you sit around in a circle and people share their own experiences, I found that they listen to each other, they learn from each other. Early on, as I said, when they could not believe that our reproductive rights could be taken away, they also thought they were very hesitant to embrace gays and lesbians' right to be, but that changed over time, right? So it was like a sea change that you couldn't even mark. It was like when I started out, there was this underlying, well, we're not sure about this, we're not gonna go there. And then all of a sudden it was full bloomed and everybody was very ready to accept GLBTQ rights and see that they were extremely important. So there are some things that they teach each other that they move on with time, and some things that the wider world has to teach them, and I think they're a little slower at picking up on what the wider world has to teach them. But I think that I always loved to teach what was called the Introduction to Women's Studies in my day, because you would open their eyes, because you would have the facts, and because you would say, well, you know, 20,000 Native Americans were sterilized in the years 1960 to 65. That would really hit them. And then they would also talk about their own experiences. And you, I know, talked with Amanda Cost about domestic violence. That's another unifying principle for women. Almost everybody has had some experience with violence in their lives. And I think that they listen to each other about that as well.
Thank you. Yeah, listen to each other and learn from each other is what you said, and that was your last thought there as well. And that's a terrific takeaway for all of us. That's the purpose of this whole Tim Talk podcast series, as a matter of fact, to make sure that as we talk about justice issues, as we talk about social and medical justice in particular, let's listen to each other and let's learn from each other. It's so much more fun than to debate each other.
Right.
So thank you for that. Now, as I mentioned to our listeners in the introduction, you are a member of the Somali Narratives Project based in Lewiston. Can you tell us a bit about that work?
Yeah. I'm sad to say that I am not doing that anymore, that this was in the past, maybe 10 years ago. However, it's still a very vibrant issue for me, and I would like to tell you about what it was like to be part of this Somali Narrative Project. There were four faculty members who invited, at first, three Somali students to join us in a discussion about the culture and history of Somalia. These three students had left under crisis conditions when they were very young, so they didn't necessarily know themselves what the culture or what the history was. So we read books together, talked about it. We decided to go into the community and interview people in the community about their experiences. We had a memorable moment in the community where the students went with us, and we thought we would have a community-wide discussion about what they would like the Somali Narrative Project to do for them. We were really conscious that we didn't want to come in and study and go away and not leave anything behind, right? Just taking and not giving back. So we had this idea. We put posters up all over the city in Somali. So we thought we were very proud of ourselves. Everybody can read this poster, and we're going to be here, and we'll have food. And we had a big discussion about, well, should we separate men and women? Is that what they're going to expect? And if we do, this is how we do it. Well, we went, and nobody came. So we sat there for about 20 minutes, and there was nobody there. And then our students said, we'll help you out. So they went out into the streets, and in about 10 minutes, we had a full room of people, all of whom wanted to join us in the discussion, were ready to tell us what it was that they wanted. And many of them said, we want some stories. Our children are losing the stories of what it was like to live in Somalia, and we don't want them just to think about the war, the civil war, and the desperation that they left, but the culture and what it was like before. So that, I think, was what propelled us to interview, to go out and do interviews with a number of different Somalis. We also, with the students, developed a reader's theater script that was based on literature by Somalis and memoirs by Somalis. And we took it around the state with the students. So we would go and read from this, and it covered the Civil War, the aftermath, what it was like in the diaspora, and presented it. And then the audience, of course, asked questions. And it was always the students and not us who answered the questions, because they knew. And we were just, I don't know what, the handmaids or something. We were just there to make it all possible. And I would say it was awesome. And then we published a book, so we combined some of the interviews and different stories that the students created and that some of us created. And it's one of the things that I most enjoyed in my life was the Somali Narrative Project. And I think it could be done in a lot of cases still today with different refugees.
Maisie, I was going to ask you that question of where does that sort of stack up as you look back on all the things that you're proudest about in your professional life, and you just answered it for me. And as I was listening to you, I was thinking about one of my most rewarding times in my professional life was when I was right next door to Somalia in Ethiopia in 2006-07. And the fact that I learned so much just by asking questions, immersing myself in their families, they would welcome me into their homes and share absolutely everything under the sun. So the culture was really terrific. But as it relates to gender equality, and there wasn't anything overtly that I could see that was really, you know, showed any different, you know, value of women as opposed to men and that kind of thing. But I'll never forget, you know, the old Maya Angelou saying, never forget how people made you feel. Remember how I felt when I was talking with some of my friends and people that I associated with and that kind of a thing. And I said, life is a gift. And I truly live that way. I truly believe that. And I remember one of the women in the crowd replied right back, and English was a second language, but she mastered it. She said, they called me Mati, that was my nickname, Mati, life is a knife. And I said, explain that a bit. Yeah. And so she told me that's a different side, you know, that maybe meets most people's eye. So again, listen and learn. And it can be a joyous listening and learning and valuing other cultures. And it can also be just eye-opening, so you have a deeper humility and appreciation for others and what they've had to go through.
What you're expressing, being in conversation with these people, I think the Ethiopians and Somalis, I found all the time working with our students in the community. And I think one of the things that I took away is I certainly can't say that women in Somalia were on a par with men and had no problems, right? That's not the case at all. But people change over time. Already the young people were really moving, pushing for change, but not embracing the West more as much as looking within, critiquing their own, and moving forward with that. And that was wonderful to learn, and I think there were a lot of values that the Somalis hold dear, the generosity, the welcoming everybody to come and sit down and share your food. We should learn from that, right? So there are all these little subtle differences that I think are very important to experience, because you realize how deep and complex a culture is.
Yes, yeah. Very true. So, Maisie, you're also working on a Maine feminist oral history project with Partners for Peace. As we said previously, a domestic violence prevention agency based in Bangor. It's a great agency that does such important work. And as you mentioned, Amanda Cost was a previous guest on Tim Talk, and there was a really just such a valuable conversation we had. She shared that it's important that we know the truth about domestic violence so that we can better defend against it and defeat it. Writing history is about documenting truth. What truths is this project revealing, and could these truths bring social and medical justice closer to domestic violence survivors?
The truth, I think, is again twofold. The truth is, first of all, that domestic violence is extremely hard to get rid of in any society. And I think that I learned that very well in conversation with the people who started Spruce Run. What they did over the, we did a history of the organization of Spruce Run, right? So we talked with them about why they got started, what they found, and what they did. And it is so clear that they achieved a huge amount, right? So when they first started, and probably Amanda talked about this, but there were priests and ministers who would encourage the women to stay with their matters, right? They would say, the family is all important. Stay with your, stay. You can overcome this. Just stay with them. So, and also people within the hospital, they said, would have wife battering jokes when a woman would come in bruised and battered. So those things have really been addressed by Partners for Peace now. And people, I think, really, well, for instance, people are aware when they read the crime statistics that half of the deaths in Maine are intimate violent deaths. They know, so they are aware of what's going on, but how to deal with it beyond supporting the individuals, working as Spruce Run and then Partners for Peace did with the police to train them what to look for, with the ministers to train them what to look for, with the educators. I know that maybe 5 years ago at the University of Maine, there were a series of trainings for everybody working at the University of Maine about how you can support people who work for you who may be experiencing domestic violence. So I think that the more information gets out, the more that it is, I say normalized, and I don't mean normalized so everybody should do it, but normalized so that everybody realizes it can happen to anybody. You know, it's not just somebody from poor homes that experience this. But the hard thing is how critical control is to the batterer and how hard it is to interrupt that cycle of control. And I think that we need, and I know that Amanda Cost and all the people in Partners for Peace feel the same thing. We need such a groundswell of change in our society, which in a sense goes back to my discussion of how men were in control and they thought they should be in control, and the women were kind of a nuisance to say they shouldn't be. We have to get back to really looking at that, changing it if there's any way possible to do it. So I didn't come up with any good solutions, but I think that I couldn't possibly do better than Partners for Peace does in their work.
Yeah, and I think what you also did is you, again, tied together what I believe I'm hearing, and I hope our listeners do as well, a theme through this podcast. And again, that is listen to each other and learn from each other. You know, so we had a couple of different podcasts on domestic violence, and as you know from your own work, The caution about sharing any of that and keeping it hidden and that kind of thing, that's also what we're talking about, is if, you know, let's listen to those that are experiencing this. Let's learn from the situation. So then maybe as a society we can do better, and we won't feel like we had to treat the symptoms, but we can get right to the root cause.
Right. And we really owe tribute. I'm thinking also, as you're talking about how in the 70s women who had had abortions claimed their abortion, which was a very difficult thing to do in the society, which said this was taboo. And today they're doing the same thing. And the women who have been battered, same idea. It takes courage to go up and say, I am somebody who's experienced this, when so many people think it's your own fault. I guess that's the big issue.
Yes.
That, right, if you had it, was because you deserved it in some way, and you have to overcome that.
Right. Yeah, you said courage, and that made me think of the word humility, and probably in younger days of my life and my career, those two terms weren't connected, you know? But now they really are. Being courageous equals being humble. Thank you so much, Dr. Mazie Huff, for sharing all of this work with us. Is there, if our listeners want to learn more about any of these topics we've discussed, how can they find out more information? And also, is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners today?
The information, I think that you have to go to your public library or to the Fogler Library, and there is a massive amount of information now about women's history. I would be happy to share my syllabi over various times to give people an idea of what they should be looking for. And I think for the domestic violence, we're talking about the Somali Narrative Project. We have a book called Somalis in Maine, which gives a good overview, I think, of what it was we did and what we found when we were there. I didn't talk about employment issues, and that kind of seems strange, but I wanted to just say a few words about it
because
we only have 83 cents on the dollar now, and it's been since 63, the Equal Pay Act happened. And if we go way back to the 1840s and 50s, men organized on the basis of wanting to have a family wage. So they were saying, we have to make more money because we're men. And women, as a result, got about half, if that, of what men earned for whatever they did. So in Maine, if you were a teacher in the 1880s, if you were male, you got $40, and if you were a woman, you got $14 for the month. So it's a huge issue. At the same time, men thought that women couldn't organize, weren't capable of changing things, especially in their workplace environments, even though women went out on strike. And there was a wonderful strike in New York called the Uprising of the 20,000, when Jewish women who were immigrant women decided that they had had enough, and one young 22-year-old said, I'm here to, it's now or never, follow me out, and everybody followed her out, and wealthy women joined her as what was called the Mink Brigade, because they were wealthy and they could kind of protect the working women from the police. So I guess I want to share the idea that we talk all the time about divisiveness and conflict, and there are always issues that divide everybody. And I've talked only about men versus women in a way, and I want to make sure people know that there's a lot of cross-class collaboration, there's a lot of cross-race collaboration, and a lot of cross-gender collaboration. So it's important to know that has been in the past and will work in the present.
You know, a lot of our listeners are Northern Light Health colleagues. Yeah. And as I said to you, and we were getting to know each other, you know, more than half of our workforce, you know, is female.
Wow.
And yeah. So we need to, and we count on, right, obviously, those individuals to do everything that we do for the, right, the consumers of healthcare and the communities that we serve. Mm-hmm. You know, we do that with a deep calling and a deep purpose. You know, we have something called our culture of caring, which we invest in day out all the time. And talking about these kinds of issues and learning about, you know, gender issues and equity issues, be it for gender or other topics that we've covered. It's a central part of who we are at Northern Light. I'm really thankful that you could take time out and share, you know, this life lesson, really, as an inquisitive a professional into these types of matters from so many different perspectives, too. It's really a fascinating career that you've had, and thank you for sharing that with us, Maisie.
Well, thank you very much. This was fun.
Thank you for being here again, Dr. Huff. Thank you to our podcast listeners, too. Until next time, I'm Tim Dentry, encouraging you to listen and act to promote our culture of caring, diversity, and inclusion that starts with caring for one another. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Tim Talk. If you enjoyed this podcast, please join us next month for a new episode. There are several ways you can tune into Tim Talk. You can find new episodes on our website at northernlighthealth.org/podcast. We are also on Google, Apple, and Podbean, which makes it easier for you to listen on the go on your favorite app.